There are many banks, especially here in Asia, where there is no fees. I can transfer money between accounts in Asia with no fees.
What are some examples?
Well, I'd rather not give examples of my bank accounts.
I thought you only had crypto. You're not a real crypto guy.
Eddie Travia is back.
A blockchain pioneer and the co-founder at Coincilium Group.
The first ever crypto company to be listed on a stock exchange.
He is also the CEO at Bizant Network.
A Web3 social network for creatives.
Why do you think that sacrificing everything is required for an entrepreneur to be successful?
I've seen very talented entrepreneurs give up a few months before the largest hype bull run cycle that was coming. And that's where persistence and sacrifice comes in. If they continued 6 months more, they could have been successful.
Why would you say that crypto as a whole is almost like a savior of financial institutions?
Because financial institutions need new products, and they also need products that have click with a new audience. If you look at the younger generation, it's not easy for these banks to be relevant for the needs of the new users.
You advise people or younger people to still own Bitcoin, but I don't own any Bitcoin.
Entrepreneurs love challenges. Maybe Bitcoin today has become less of a challenge. In a way, ETF marks an end and a beginning. It could lead into a different form of entrepreneurship.
Would you go as far as saying that we should decentralize everything?
We should try to decentralize everything because...
Why are you so bullish on Yellow Network and Alexis Yurka team?
So it goes back a bit to what we were talking about.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have the pleasure to announce that we're teaming up with Astar Network on this show. Astar Network is a decentralized blockchain platform that aims to bring billions of people into Web3. And the Astar team has a very specific strategy to make this happen, to partner with the biggest conglomerates in Web2 and help them onboard their customers into our world, the Web3 world. Startail Labs, a core developer for Astar Network, is currently working hand in hand with Sony, the business division of the conglomerate that created the PlayStation, in order to develop Sony's own public blockchain network. The development of a new Sony public blockchain is a huge step towards the goal of Web3 mass adoption, as Sony has a very large user base who could hugely benefit from the benefits of a more decentralized world where assets can be fully owned and transferred effortlessly. The team behind Astar are people with high integrity and great values. I'm lucky to call Sota, the founder of Astar, a friend, and trust him deeply to have the best interests of the industry and of all its participants at heart. If you want to check out for yourself, I invite you to watch the candid podcast I recorded with Sota Watanabe, the founder of Startail Labs and Astar Network. And please, 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 if you enjoy this show, hit the like button, leave a comment in the comment section, and subscribe to this channel. The more subscribers, the better the guests. Thank you so much for your help. And now on to today's episode.
So we are in this beautiful Barbie setup with you, Eddie. You're the first one coming on the show for the second time.
Thank
which
you.
Means you're a special one. How does it feel?
Great for now.
We started talking about Barbie, so not too risky for the moment. Can you just start telling people who you are before we dive deeper into today's subjects?
Yes, sure. So Eddie Travia, I've been in this space since, active in the space since 2013. At the time, me and some co-founders, two co-founders, we decided to help the community, mainly by facilitating financing of, at the time, Bitcoin startups, because there were no other type of cryptocurrencies. And we also happened to organize the first Bitcoin conference in Asia, which was called Bitcoin Singapore 2013. And that happened in November 15 in Singapore. And that was the beginning of quite an exciting adventure in this space. So we traveled a lot. And then eventually, December 2015, we listed a company called Coincilium, of which I'm still CEO and co-founder. And we have been investing in this space, in blockchain companies, now for almost 9 years now. And in addition, we have done advisory, and now we do a bit of what we call venture building, which means being more active into the building or the development, especially on the commercial side, advisory side of certain projects in Web3.
So you said you started your crypto journey in 2013, which is pretty much more than 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a really big event happening last week with the Bitcoin ETF approval. Is it something that you were kind of foreseeing when you started 10 years ago? If I remember, I think the Winklevoss brothers, they applied for a Bitcoin ETF in 2013 or something like that.
Yeah.
And there was someone saying on Twitter the other day, oh, SEC, you're supposed to, you know, protect investors or like help them navigate markets, but you've been denying a crypto or Bitcoin ETF for 10 years. And meanwhile, Bitcoin is up 58,000%. Well, I don't remember the number, something like ridiculous, right? So you prevented people from participating into this amazing asset class. So is it something that you were also foreseeing, or you're more thinking, oh, there's something interesting here, but I don't know how big this is going to become? Because you decided to leave everything to go all in crypto already 10 years ago, right?
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, especially on the, I would say, the professional daily activity, I decided to really focus on it. I liked many things about Bitcoin, and I thought it could go big, but of course, it's difficult to foresee exactly where it can go. But yes, I remember very clearly the ETF application. I think, you know, my experience, because we decided to list a company that is investing in blockchain companies, my experience is there was still so much education to be done. You know, when we were talking to brokers, market makers in London, we were spending an hour to explain, you know, where Bitcoin comes from and what is blockchain, and you know, all these basics that today are, you know, more taken for granted, and people have, you know, read about it, learned about it. So I would say probably too early for a Bitcoin ETF in 2013. But of course, it was a good direction. So we felt, and even if you look at, you know, 2016, 17, 18, I mean, of course, 17, 18, you have this boom of interest. But just before, there were still many, many mainstream companies that had no idea what is Bitcoin, what is blockchain. So I think ETF could have definitely come earlier, you know. But 2013, probably not. Was probably early, yeah.
Why do you think it has taken such a long time?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, everybody's speculating on the internet for such and such reason. It's interesting because by taking so long, as even members of the SEC mentioned, you know, by taking so long, it makes a big deal out of it, which not necessarily should be the case. You know, like, because there is all this pent up demand, there is also this expectation that it will come. There is all this. So it's interesting that eventually we have many, many large companies, you know, Fidelity, et cetera, BlackRock, huge $1 trillion management companies and we feel some excitement, which is very, very interesting because, you know, it's not every day you have excitement in the financial world, right? It's not like an ETF is usually such a incredibly exciting event. So I think it built up to now, and whatever the reason, I think the timing is not bad for right now. I mean, for, you know, after the terrible year we had in final 2022 and 2023, I think it's a good sign now. You know, it comes probably at a good time.
Do you remember when the first gold ETF was approved?
I don't remember, but I've read about it, and there is a lot of parallels now being drawn between the two. So I don't remember. I remember ETFs have been quite successful in the financial markets for now, I don't know, maybe a couple of decades, I would say. But I don't remember like being expecting the gold ETF with a lot of excitement, to be honest.
Fair enough. So what does it concretely mean for the crypto industry as a whole that we have, what, 11 or 12? I think 11.
11, I think, yeah.
Big companies managing trillions of dollars all approved, or got a Bitcoin ETF approved at once. What does it concretely mean for the industry?
I think it reflects first the fact that Bitcoin is recognized as an asset class. Bitcoin is recognized as an asset that can sustain, absorb that kind of market activity. Of course, you know, Bitcoin trading volume as, you know, I have presentations I was doing in 2015, 16, where the volume was a few millions, you know, where the prices were, you know, $300, $400, et cetera. So we have, first of all, a huge expansion of the interest. We have a huge expansion of the daily volume of this asset. And let's not forget, it's a it's a seven, you know, it's a 7-day, 24-hour trading, right? You know, the ETF won't be, but the Bitcoin is and the crypto is, right? So I think it basically reflects the maturity that the whole sector has achieved. And of course, everything boils down back to Bitcoin because that's the origin of the whole cryptocurrency sector.
So we're basically witnessing the evolution of our sector with especially, you know, BlackRock kind of at the helm of movement. We even have, you know, Larry Fink, who is now the kind of, people call him the new Paul Tudor Jones. But on steroids, he's kind of like our biggest chill, and he's already talking about tokenizing every asset on the blockchain and how the blockchain can prevent financial frauds and many other things. Isn't that amazing for our industry? Or is there something that's potentially negative?
Well, I think it's a cycle that has been kind of repeating itself. Is when you have, first of all, there haven't been many, you know, new asset classes coming, you know. But of course, we had a massive wave of, for example, interest in derivatives, you know, a massive wave of new products around derivatives, which are usually derivatives on stocks, derivatives on bonds, and so forth. But I would say that this is kind of really the 21st century asset that no one expected. And I think the positive, and I'm not surprised that large fund managers are excited about it or are positive about it. Let's remember that Fidelity, for example, has been positive about it for years. You know, so there have been funds that have been looking at this for years already, very early on, right? And of course, all these big funds that invested in Coinbase, for example, 10 years ago, you know, Coinbase had a round in 2013, I remember in spring, and then they continue investing in Coinbase, in other blockchain companies. They must have had some degree of interest in the whole space, right? So the cycle that I'm trying to refer to is a cycle whereby, you know, you have a new product, it comes from unexpected corners of the, I don't know, scientific space in this case, you know, cryptography, you know, for example. It evolves into something that becomes very meaningful, very relevant at the economic level. But at the same time, because it's apolitical, it raises a lot of question marks, right? Especially the regulatory space, of course. So in a way, what we see is the acceptance, the slow acceptance first, you know, as you know, first nobody cares and, you know, slowly it gets accepted. And at the end, I think it becomes almost, you know, maybe salvation is a big word, but I think it's going to become a product that helps a lot the established, the legacy financial systems, those that Bitcoin ideologically was almost going against in a way, right? Bitcoin was the no central bank currency, right? So if you start putting all in the same basket, central banks and the largest institutional funds of the world, which is technically not the same, but, you know, let's say they have a similar ideology or the way, and they have to work together, obviously, in many ways, then we see that this is getting to the point where Bitcoin and cryptocurrency assets are actually going to help these legacy institutions make money and reach an audience that maybe they wouldn't have reached, and help retail investors, certain retail investors who maybe initially or for years have been either indifferent or against Bitcoin or crypto, and now they can actually own a piece of, you know, of this Bitcoin, you know, major financial disruptive asset ecosystem, let's say.
I understand, but why would you say, I mean, you said that savior is almost too big of a word, right? But why would you basically say that crypto as a whole is almost like a savior of legacy financial institutions?
Because financial institutions need new products, and they also need new products that have click with a new audience. And if you look at the new audience, if you look at the younger generation, They have gone through, for example, neobanks. You know, they have gone through a different way of banking, and large institutions have adapted to that. They have created new products, etc. And we see that the banking model is declining. I mean, you know, Citigroup, I think, just announced 20,000 jobs cut off, right? And Citigroup is an example of a very traditional legacy, you know, bank. And it's not easy for these banks to be relevant for the younger generations, for the needs of the new users. So I think crypto fits in that particular segment where something exciting is coming. You know, something exciting. Also, the fact that it's speculative, the fact that it can go many times, you know, it can be a very lucrative type of financial investment, and it's a different type of financial investment. So I think it's going to become one of the, you know, star products of banks and legacy establishments in this space. I think so. Yeah,
it's pretty much the asset class of the new generation because of the potential returns, because of how fun it is, all the memes.
Yeah, there is a new community vibe around it, new users. But of course, you know, as an early Bitcoiner, we still advise, you know, people to actually own Bitcoin, right? Because, well, many reasons. Of course, the first reason being that you can still trade peer-to-peer without, you know, without barriers, regulatory barriers and so forth. But you know, ETFs fulfill a role. There is a role for them to fill.
I love that you say that as an early Bitcoiner, you advise people or younger people to still own Bitcoin, because I don't own any Bitcoin. So.
Yeah, but you own other crypto.
Yeah, absolutely. But like, no, and when you said before, like our generation kind of like needs, you know, with neobanks, the Revolut, Bonzo, TransferWise, etc., we're used to like a digital, a different user experience for sure.
Yeah, user.
But also, like the other day, I was giving a class in my previous school where I studied, and they paid me for that. But I didn't, obviously, like I said, okay, here's how much it's going to cost. And I just trusted them, gave them a bank account from the UK, right? Because I have a bank in the UK and because they're based in Spain. So I was like, it's not too far. I don't know why. I was just thinking geographically, you know, UK, Spain, not too far. Okay, different currency, but not too far. Less bad than if I give a Singapore bank account. And then I just looked at how much I received compared to like how much they sent.
They're supposed to pay.
You know how much fees got taken from this one transaction? 9%.
Whoa.
9%. And I was like, damn, man. Like, and the actual class was about, a big part was about crypto and Bitcoin. And then I was just like, I understand. I understand why Bitcoin and crypto and stable coins, because this is crazy. And like, no, whereas our parents' generation might say, oh, you know, businesses or banks, they need to earn their bread, right? People who, they have to employ people. So it's normal that you need to pay fees and everything. Our generation were like, fuck that. I'm not going to pay 9% fees. And just accept that it's because the banker needs to buy a nice suit and a nice car, right?
No, the reality is it's a ledger entry. It's two ledger entries, if you think about it, right? I mean, of course, it's more complex than this, but it's basically a message between two banks on a network that is still centralized. And you have a ledger entry on the sending bank and a ledger entry on the receiving bank. So it shouldn't be that expensive. But yes, there are these costs. Yeah, and you were teaching your students how to remove these costs.
I was more explaining about why Bitcoin and wage deflation and asset price inflation.
Yeah.
So more in a way like, what is retirement? You know, like why do people work? And so it's basically to acquire enough assets so that one day the dividend or interest can cover your life expenses. But the problem is if there is fiat currency devaluation, because governments, they print money every time there is a war or an economic crisis, then your currency debasement has a big impact, because most people don't earn more money in their jobs.
Sure, sure.
But the asset prices go up. They need more and more time to acquire these same asset amount that would be enough to retire. So I was more expecting, because I was just thinking this is probably more the approach
that makes sense to people who don't really understand crypto and like why they should care about that. But you talked about the neobanks. So we have the banks charging 9%, terrible. Then we have the neobanks, which I think are amazing to use. But if you're critical about the whole thing, the model, I don't really know if you can say they're successful, because as much as, you know, first neobanks, probably 2014, 15, like it's probably when I moved in London, where like Revolut started, Monzo.
Yes, around that time, yeah.
And these different ones, N26. And the promise was from Storonsky, the founder, CEO of Revolut, was we're going to build a bank that is 10 times cheaper and 10 times faster and 10 times better. Mm-hmm. And it's true, at least in the beginning. But I don't think at some point they had to increase fees, right? Because the actual business model was not very different. It was more, okay, maybe you're building, you don't have all these physical banks, so it's cheaper. You use AI and a bunch of other technologies so you can make things cheaper. But at the end of the day, the business model was the same, was taking transaction fees and let's make them free or as low as possible, subsidized by VCs that were basically full of money because of money printing, you know, the 10 years of like free money. But then at some point, this kind of didn't really work out anymore. And now
you have different things that happen at the same time. First of all, banks understand and become competitive, right? They're not stupid. They can see, okay, somebody's coming with new ideas. They're grabbing a market share from us. So we're going to either create a new bank, invest in a new bank, or start replicating and compete. For example, now there are many banks, especially here in Singapore, Asia, where there is no fees. You know, I can transfer money between accounts in Asia with no fees. And they're not the same banks, but they are somehow, I guess, in the same network, right? Mm. So there is absolutely no fees. So
that's examples.
So that's, I'd rather not give examples of my bank accounts. But I
thought about
Asian
that
banks.
While I was actually was like, maybe not.
Asian banks. So the same.
I thought you only had crypto, no cash.
Well,
you're not a real crypto guy.
I think most crypto guys have bank accounts. Mm. So
empty bank accounts, but bank accounts.
Yeah, exactly. So there's this the fact that there is a competition, right? Also, it's very difficult. I mean, it has always been very difficult for companies to compete with banks. Why? Because don't forget, the actual infrastructure is banks. So, for example, in the early days of crypto exchanges, what was their biggest problem? No banks, right?
No bank. Even now, I think it's still difficult.
It's still difficult. Yeah. So it means that you are creating a new product. It's like a new application on a protocol that you don't control at all, and a protocol you compete with. So basically, the owners of the infrastructure of the banking system are actually your competitors. So if they want to make your life difficult, they can. Yeah, basically, that's what it means, right? Mm. So but it's interesting because then I think we come to a convergence where we see that actually banks facilitate certain, you know, cheap transfers, etc. Reminds me a bit of the telecom world, like nobody's calling a landline anymore, right? So for me, landline and bank transfer is the same. It's like this becomes the basic service and it should be zero because it's like your basic service. It's not the differentiating service. Like it's not the investment service. It's not the value added service where you're going to really make a difference. So that should be the zero cost basic foundation. But of course, the problem is, for example, in Europe, as you experienced, it's very expensive because you go from Europe, you know, system, you know, the European clearing system to the UK clearing system, which happens to be two very different systems, and therefore you start paying, right? I guess if you use SEPA in Europe, like Spain to France, Spain to Italy, Luxembourg, whatever, then it may be free or near free and real time or near real time, right? Mm. So it's interesting to see that in Asia, they managed in between, for example, Hong Kong, Singapore, maybe Japan, you know, they managed to find ways to make it nearly free, nearly instant. But this is coming. I think we're coming to the fact where, okay, transfer is not where you should really differentiate yourself. I think Revolut, for example, they have started crypto, you know, they have started a lot of different services where you can really create value. But, you know, in a way, ETF is the same thing. You know, ETF becomes a financial product on legacy financial infrastructure. You know, for an ETF, you basically have clearinghouses, market makers, you have all the infrastructure that you need for financial markets. You don't circumvent that because it's a Bitcoin spot ETF, obviously. Yeah. You only circumvent it in the crypto space. But you know, the financial market is still much larger than the crypto market. So there's still room for, you know, both to grow extensively. But people have to be aware that they are intrinsically different. When I started crypto, being involved in crypto 2013, before that, I remember very well, 2010, 2012, I was really looking into P2P lending and crowdfunding. And it's interesting that crypto has taken these concepts to a new level, you know, because obviously P2P lending, it can be DeFi today, mm-hmm. and crowdfunding is obviously, you know, ICO, token sales, etc. And it has taken this to a new level with much less regulatory oversight, which has its pros and cons, of course. You know, we are very much aware there have been many scams in this space, but there have been many scams in the regulated space as well, or other problems. So we have these two, these concepts that have evolved. They haven't disappeared at all. They've just evolved into something new and very useful. So when DeFi started in July 2020, I wrote an article about the coded income model. And the idea was DeFi is going to be great. You know, at the time, the total value was locked on DeFi was like maybe $3 billion, which is today nothing for DeFi. But DeFi at the time was also mainly Ethereum, right? So today is many other chains. So coded income model, the thesis was very simple. Like DeFi has many advantages. Why not look into replicating these advantages in the entrepreneurial space for funding companies, for funding real economy, basically, like, you know, shops, stores, e-commerce websites, I don't know. So it was, you know, and I think we're getting there to the convergence of crypto and real economy, whereby you can start using these products for regular, let's say, regular entrepreneurial ventures, business, small businesses.
Which means that we're kind of failing, right, in crypto. Because if the idea is, hey, there's this Bitcoin invention that is supposed to be in the beginning peer-to-peer electronic cash, but then becomes a sort of digital gold store of value. And then from that, there is some smart people like Vitalik Buterin who say, we can't, it's not really programmable, right? So we need to build something else called Ethereum where we can build a sort of iOS or Android for decentralized applications. So the underlying infrastructure of the new internet, which is going to be, how do we decentralize everything, right? How do we build, how do we remove the toll collector, which is this bank that takes 9% on my... my money, basically, right? And you apply this to different industries. But now what's happening? So the kind of dream was, hey, we can decentralize everything. But now we're just ending. So are we not there yet? Or are we basically not going to get there because we're ending back into the black rocks of this world and saying, hey, actually, people will just buy Bitcoin or Bitcoin ETF on their Charles Schwab broker account.
Yeah, but think about it. It's very interesting because when we were talking about neobanks, neobanks had to build on the banking infrastructure. Now, if you are Fidelity or BlackRock, you have to rely on the Bitcoin infrastructure. You have to make sure that the Bitcoin network is working. You know, that's why, for example, Bitwise and others have announced they're going to spend a portion of their fees for the Bitcoin core network development.
I think VanEck too, right?
Yes, VanEck as well.
Which is more kind of like traditional.
So it shows almost the opposite is coming. It's like these people will understand that in order to sell billions of dollars of ETF shares or units,
the thing needs to work.
They need Bitcoin to work, right? They need Bitcoin to be doing what it should be doing. And at the beginning, for the first years, only a few core developers and a few newbies to Bitcoin were the ones worried about it. Now we're going to have these huge companies, trillion-dollar companies, worried about the state of the network, the state of the evolution of Bitcoin. These people were not involved in the early discussions, you know, size and block size and mining, et cetera, mining standards. You know, they were not involved at all, you know. And now slowly we see, and we there was also an example of Société Générale in France, which has done a proposal on MakerDAO, you know, et cetera. So we see this kind of new work of banks in crypto, and yes, crypto may use, let's say, may have to go through traditional regulatory doors, of course, for certain things to happen. Of course, that we know that from the beginning. So I think it's interesting now that we have products that rely on the Bitcoin network and not the opposite. So also, crypto is not only Bitcoin, obviously. I mean, Bitcoin is a origin. Bitcoin is very important, is, as you're saying, a digital gold. But if you look at what's going on in Web3 on any blockchain, you know, Ethereum, Solana, etc., you know, Polygon, you know, L2s, etc., you have a lot of creativity, you have a lot of innovation, and it's not necessarily in a financial space. You know, it could be social media space, could be identity, you know, could be IP, you know, it could be many other spaces where finance regulation is not that important, basically.
So the logical next step to this conversation is exactly what we talked about the other day, which is it's great, this Bitcoin ETF, for many reasons that we talked about and more. But the problem is, it's not really, I mean, Bitcoin and Ethereum, I mean, Bitcoin now, but probably Ethereum in the next 6 months, if there is an ETF approved, is not going to be where the real opportunity lies anymore for crypto and blockchain entrepreneurs. Why?
Yeah, I mean, yes, in a way, again, there is a certain, you know, when there's a certain degree of maturity comes, there is obviously less opportunity, you know, in terms of, first of all, the community is much larger. There has been acceptance into certain circles. So entrepreneurs tend to look at sectors which are underrated, you know, sectors which are still like the Bitcoin 10 years ago, where nobody wants to touch it, nobody cares, et cetera. The community is small. And of course, innovation. So I think there are other opportunities in crypto now. And of course, working in the investment space, we always look for the next, you know, the new cycle, the opportunity that will mature and that will become, that will represent a return, possibly an asymmetric return, maybe in 5 years from now, you know, for example. So obviously, Bitcoin at this level of maturity is a good asset, an asset I would encourage everyone to hold.
So what are the big opportunities? Where do they lie for crypto entrepreneurs now that Bitcoin and Ethereum have been validated by big institutions and therefore became an asset class rather than a sort of true technological playground?
Well, I mean, to be clear, Bitcoin from the start was and is a payment mechanism. I mean, the whole financial digital gold came on organically in a way, and because people realized, well, let's rely on math, you know, instead of relying on politicians or central bankers, you know, et cetera. So I think that is doing its job, you know, very well. And Bitcoin was not necessarily meant to become the infrastructure of a very advanced technology solutions. So for example, I think anything to do today with the ownership of data, I mean, it's something that has been going on for years. I mean, it's not new, but I think there are solutions today where personal ownership of your data, and of course, today our life is much on social networks, on internet and on social networks. So today, very clearly in the Web2 time, if you're using the regular social media Web2, each of them has your data. Each of them is centralizing your data. There is no portability, no interoperability. You cannot do anything with that data. It's in their database. And you cannot monetize your data because it's in their database. They are making money from it. They're making money from the content you generated. So there is a misalignment here between the interests, and also this lack of portability is prevents a lot of positive things to happen and prevents a lot of opportunities of you to use your data for, you know, building communities, building a business, maybe building an image, etc. So basically, in a way, a lot of the influencers are kind of hostages of these platforms, because if tomorrow, you know, Twitter, Facebook decide, oh, you're saying something I don't like, you're out. And maybe you have 1 million followers and that, maybe that's how you were making your, you know, earning your revenues. You're out because you said something, you showed something, you just made a mistake, or we made a mistake, we got hacked and we lost everything. So I think clearly there is an opportunity to go into what we call decentralized, you know, Web3 social media, and primarily for owning your data, porting your data where you need to, sharing your data with whoever you want, and monetizing your data and the content you generate. Instead of having the platforms having the lion's share of that, you have the lion's share. You share some with the platform because they enable you, but not in a crazy way that is happening now when these companies make billions of dollars of advertising and you know, a user get basically nothing, just the fact that they can use these platforms. So I think we're going there. And identity is not really a byproduct, but more what we call, you know, primitive. We make a foundation block of this is that we have to look at identity differently, because we have an identity on the internet, on digital, you know, applications. And identity becomes very important in that space as well. So that's why there is a project, for example, Byzant, in which we are investors, and we have an interest in it. And with Byzant, what is important is the fact that we are, you know, the Byzant applications are going to help their users to share their data, monetize their data, and use tools that are available today to Web2 platforms, but use it in a Web3 decentralized context.
Do you want to give an example or two of how a Byzant network and one or two of these tools really help users have a different and much better experience with social media that they have today with Web2 social media?
Well, in terms of user experience, to be clear, you know, Byzant is using tools that are, I think, great and evolving, like Lens Protocol, which is enabling this portability, which is basically a social graph for Web3 apps, and has, you know, hundreds of applications already. But still, user experience will take time, you know, to get as smooth, because of course centralized is always smoother, as we know, because, you know, everything is in a database. Fast here, we have to connect with the blockchain, so that always takes some time. You still need smart contracts. But beyond user experience, getting to the point where it's getting closer to what you experience in Web2, what is very important is, there are these tools that are getting built to give you a different experience, not necessarily a better in terms of speed or, you know, but a different experience in terms of controlling your data, owning and monetizing. So one example is advertising. So the Byzant team is working on AdBazaar, which is a decentralized advertising network. Also programmatic in the sense that it's going to look at the assets on a wallet, but this is public information. There is nothing special there. It's going to look on assets on a wallet. And if, for example, a user has certain NFTs or gaming tokens, gaming NFTs, etc., it can change the type of advertising that this user is going to see or going to be served. But with this model of advertising, users can also become publishers and can also earn money from advertising directly, not having to, without the need of going through, centralized intermediaries. So there is this. So this is one example of a tool, and you have to remember that Web2 is built on advertising, basically.
So earning money from advertisement, that's great. But how is the first part better than what we have today? Because today, Facebook or Instagram, they even listen to me, right? They know everything. So they kind of like predict what I kind of want, or not necessarily want, because I don't like advertisement, but like they can predict extremely precisely what I'm going to buy in the next 3 weeks, right? So it's very precise. So how is the showing me advertisement based on what I have in my wallet kind of better for me as a user? Because the reason I would use Web3 is because it's better for me as a user, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the difference between what you're describing, I mean, first of all, there is no idea of listening about anything, but here, everything is around the wallet because that becomes kind of your identity, right? So your wallet has transactions. Now, if you don't want people to know, you just connect on a different wallet. It's not that complicated. But if you want to continue having different interactions through that wallet, and that wallet has participated to some airdrops, to some ICOs, has done transactions on certain DeFi application platforms and so forth, actually, you may want to show that because you know you could benefit from it because the advertising could be for something useful for your activity on chain. So I think in the sense that it's better is that you decide first if you want to give the information or not. If you don't want to give the information, you can even create a wallet on the spot. You know, there is a company we have invested in, Indoors. They have the Bastion wallet, which is also part of this Byzant ecosystem. And on Bastion, which is an account abstraction wallet, you can create with your regular Web2 platforms like email, Google, etc. You can create on the spot a wallet. And obviously that wallet would have no history at the beginning. So if you want, you can just choose a more pseudonymous type of solution.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to take a short moment to introduce our partner, Mento, who helps us make this show possible. Mento was created to hyperscale the Ethereum network with what we call a layer 2 that helps users like you and me transact much faster and at a fraction of the cost of the Ethereum network. Mento has over $2 billion in total value locked, has a mega treasury of $3.7 billion in Bitcoin, ETH, and stablecoins, and has the largest eco fund of the industry with more than $200 million to invest into new projects that want to join the Mento ecosystem. The team behind Mento are extremely smart people who I personally trust with some of my money and who I personally know outside of crypto. We actually had Ignace Ternus and Jordi Alexander on this podcast, who both are key figures in the Mento ecosystem. So I invite you to watch these two very candid and in-depth conversations to develop your own opinion. And please, 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 if you enjoy this show, hit the like button, leave a comment in the comment section, and subscribe to this channel. The more subscribers, the better the guests. Thank you so much for your help. And now on to today's episode.
So that's social media. You talked about decentralized finance, that you think it's still very early and is probably where a lot of innovation is going to happen in the next 5 years until it becomes more widely adopted by institutions, kind of like Bitcoin and Ethereum are now. Elaborate on that.
Well, I think, you know, the great thing about DeFi is that it's really a playground. I mean, you know, if you like financing strategies, if you like financial engineering, you can do a lot with DeFi. You have all, it's called composability, the fact that you can use, reuse many tools, build on existing platforms. I mean, it's very exciting for people in that, in the financial space. And it has this kind of freedom attached to it because at the moment, as long as you have a wallet, you can build any kind of strategy you want.
Do you want to define composability a bit better?
Yes, composability meaning you can pick and choose different tools that have been built by other teams, other, you know, protocols, projects, and so forth. And you can use those, integrate those in your own design. You can integrate either, you know, because open source code or because maybe they have APIs, SDKs, et cetera, or, you know, you have different ways to do that technically. But it means that basically any new DeFi is supposedly, or at least normally, should be a little bit better than another, you know, because it's basically learning from the other experience.
They call that the DeFi Lego, right?
Yes, the DeFi Lego.
Or correct. I think there is...
Correct.
I forgot his name. It's not Mark Andreessen. He's another of these dudes. He said, probably 2 years ago, he said, composability is to finance. No. Composability is to software what compound interest is to finance. So basically that it's
building
incredible.
On each other. Yeah.
Exactly.
And also building on each other.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it enables you to build applications one on top of each other that are much more powerful than if they were kind of like each segregated or on their own.
Yeah. And so DeFi is it's very interesting because the way I have been defining smart contracts, and especially in the context of DeFi until now, has been function-specific applications, meaning a smart contract is a program, which means, of course, there is no character to it, right? I mean, a smart contract does whatever it has been programmed to do. But the interesting thing is that DeFi platform should be the same. But actually, somehow, you have to choose, you know, as a user, you choose validators, you choose DeFi platforms. So you choose programs. So these programs today, like, for example, in the whatever blockchain we look at, you know, Ethereum, Polygon, Arbitrum, you know, these platforms, although they do something very function and there is no human, there is not a clear human implication in how it works. Of course, it has been designed by humans, but I mean, how it works is basic, is very deterministic, right? It gives you this result. But you still have to choose. So you're still, in a way, sensitive to branding, community, the overall vibe. So for example, it's very interesting to see these platforms. Recently, I was looking at the Solana DeFi platform. So you have many, and they basically all do almost the same, right? I mean, they are certain that are trying new things over and over. So for example, I use many of those, and one of them stands out a little bit is Camino Finance. Why? To me, just because I like the way the community is the vibe of the community. I like the way they communicate as well. And there's always something new, like a new token almost daily, you know, and the way they explain how they do. But it's very interesting to see that we are always drawn back to branding, despite the fact that all these programs are all basically doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. So there are certain differences. For example, there is a company called Fibonacci Finance. They help these DeFi platforms mitigate the risk. And they highlight certain that are doing this. There is one called MarginFi as well on Solana. So actually, if you do your own research, famous words in crypto, you can go and try to find the ones that are less risky, right? So that's very different from branding. But still, you know, it's interesting to see that there is still an element that is a little bit emotional.
You also talked about infrastructure. And
yes.
In that context, you said that internet was very open source in the 1990s.
Yeah.
A bit like crypto, but that we need to learn from what happened as the internet world got fully absorbed by huge monsters such as Amazon, Facebook, Google. And there's not much left today in the internet that's open source, right?
Yeah.
And so you told me regarding infrastructure, that the same seems to be happening in crypto today. You know what happened 30 years ago in Twitter internet, a magnet of centralization and finance, mm-hmm. and everyone uses the same platform. So essentially Coinbase is becoming the Facebook of crypto.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of, yeah, right?
In a way.
When Web3 is supposed to be decentralization of the internet and break down the monopolies, and actually what's happening, or at least what's been happening in internet and what is at risk of happening in crypto again is that the small ones who disrupt the big ones, they become even bigger than the monopolies that they disrupted.
Yeah, there is this, maybe it's called a natural cycle, but it's true that the internet you know, the vision that we have now for Web3, I mean, initially Web3 was a vision for the internet, not just Web3 for crypto-related internet, you know, but it was still a more decentralized vision for the internet. Going back to the original vision of internet, which when it was created was supposed to be a very, you know, hands-off type of network for scientists to use and then anyone to use. But we found this layer of centralization that has been built on it. Domain names is a good example. You know, domain names, ICANN, all that became very centralized, very arbitrary, you know, like, okay, you can have this name, you can have this name, you cannot do this, you cannot do that. So,
But why is that? Is it for a business opportunity? Because people who are powerful maybe realized, or if we don't find a way to centralize that, we're not going to be able to make money out of it because the underlying infrastructure doesn't allow, you know, the TCP/IP would not allow you to own a part of like something kind of decentralized, whereas now it's different with crypto. So is it that, or it's more government that came in and say, hey, like, this is how we're going to do that because to keep some sort of control?
Yeah, there's a bit of everything in the sense that, of course, you need standards. But then once you get a country, in the case of the internet, obviously the US is a country that has mostly determined early standards and that has influenced how it goes. I have a whole story that maybe people don't know, but one of the artisans of the internet is actually a Frenchman who unfortunately was not supported at the time in France in the 70s. But his name is Louis Pouzin. He created the datagram, which was the basis of TCP/IP. And then in France, they told him, oh, you know, we're going to go for another solution, which became the Minitel, which kind of delayed internet in France by like 10 years or something crazy, maybe more. So we have certain countries have taken internet more seriously. And obviously the US has been the countries that are taking internet more seriously. And yes, standards helped the internet grow to where it has become, but at the same time created decentralized points. And today, as we see, today it's interesting because most countries are trying to control not necessarily the internet, but parts of the internet, parts of the network, parts of the content, parts of, you know. So there is a political element, of course, to it. There is a political element. In the case of crypto, we have the same degree of kind of institutionalization, which can lead to removing a lot of the advantages, decentralization, et cetera, on top of it. That's why we're talking about, you know, new entrepreneurs, new blockchains, et cetera. So it's a very difficult balance because, yes, small companies in the internet have become huge and they have replaced incumbent centralized monoliths by basically themselves. And they may, and they have, or they may apply the kind of same rules. I mean, Google is an example because Google has become, you know, has become extremely, extremely present, let's say, in the internet, you know, omnipresent on the internet in a way that's difficult to avoid. And once it's difficult to avoid, of course, it's good for business because you get, you know, fees from whatever you do. But at the same time, where is the competition? Where is the innovation, et cetera? So we need a good balance. And crypto could go that way. So hopefully crypto will be... The interesting thing with crypto is that it's very wide and there are kind of pockets of innovation a bit everywhere. And until now, it's almost impossible to control it entirely.
But would you go as far as saying that we should decentralize everything?
We should try to decentralize everything because we should try to decentralize everything, but that doesn't mean that we should replace everything by smart contracts. You know, there is a risk to that. You know, smart contract is great for finance. You know, we're talking about numbers. I mean, finance is definitely already a social construct. It's a virtual, you know, we have created finance, we have created rules, we have created accounting, etc. The humans have created that. Now, so that's why for deterministic type of processes like finance, smart contract is great. It's basically doing better what centralized companies are trying to do. But there are many, many other instances, you know, for example, justice, law, you know, things that are closer to human nature, where I would say smart contracts are not the solution. So I know that in crypto there is a strong movement for, you know, code is law and so forth. And I think we have to be careful that we don't push it to the dystopian future we're trying to avoid, you know, because crypto in some parts of the ideology is we're not going to go in a world where the dystopian type of world where everything is controlled, etc. But at the same time, if tomorrow we want everything on smart contract, there is a risk that we get actually closer to that. I agree that, you know, we all know that human is imperfect. There is corruption. There are many vices that can come in. There are many personal interests that can come into designing systems, model, etc. But replacing everything by math, I don't think is a solution, because there are instances where the human input actually can make a positive difference, and definitely a positive difference. And we cannot remove it.
Do you have examples?
Well, to be honest, the example is where we are today. You know, we are not here today because of, you know, smart, you know, we are not here today because of a programming, well, unless you think you live in the matrix, but that's something that's popular on crypto Twitter. That's, I let people decide, but or have their opinions on that. But we are here today because of human evolution and millions of decisions that we have made. And of course, some of them have been disastrous. You know, they have been, we all know history, you know, they've been disastrous events. But we're here and we are evolving. And I don't think we should be as, let's say, arrogant to think that, oh, we have found a new way to rule everything, and that way is, you know, programming. I mean, in a way, it's a problem of the hammer and the nail, right? You know, when you hammer, everything is a nail. And I think, for example, the Mark Andreessen piece on software is eating the world, you know, I like it. I think it's interesting. It's probably a true approach, but pushing it to the point where we really want everything to be controlled by programming, I think that's dangerous for human evolution.
What does this world look like?
Well, exactly. I think it would look like a world where we no longer have the capacity to take decisions, right? Because I mean, don't get me wrong. There are still many, many ways data can help us. And there are still many ways that we are not using data as efficiently as we should. You know, we can still learn a lot. I mean, in health, in preventing accidents of all kinds. I mean, data, I'm not saying we should stop processing data. I mean, I think there is still great areas where we can improve our lives through data management, through data efficiencies. But then compiling this and creating programs that are going to rule the way we live and what we should do, I think that would be a mistake. We still need a very, you know, at core, we need a human element to our lives.
So from today onwards, we're adding an alpha part. We kind of touched upon a bit before, but I'd like to go a bit more in detail.
Okay.
So we're adding an alpha part where I ask the guest what specific project he or she is the most bullish on and why. Mm-hmm. And I know what you're bullish on. So I'm going to ask you one by one. The first one is a project called the Yellow Network.
Yes.
Which is a decentralized clearing network built yes. by an amazing team led by Alexis Sirkia, who is the co-founder of GSR. Mm-hmm. I know you're an early investor also with Coincilium.
In Yellow, yes.
Mm-hmm. In Yellow. So why are you so bullish on Yellow Network and Alexis Sirkia team?
So it goes back a bit to what we're talking about, infrastructure, right? I mean, what I really like about these projects is they don't look at the problem in a superficial way. They look at the foundational reasons of maybe problems. So for example, crypto trading, we're talking about DeFi. And of course, we all know that another way to trade crypto is centralized exchanges. And Yellow team has realized there are flaws in these different methods that we know, you know, centralized exchange is kind of a black box. They may or may not have the crypto you think you have, you know, because they suddenly become like a credit on your screen. DeFi, we know there are risk of vulnerabilities in smart contracts, hacking, etc. So the Yellow team looked at the infrastructure and they decided, why not create a new network on which you can trade and even trade better, faster crypto than on these two solutions that we are used to now, which is, well, there are three really. There's also OTC, which is much slower, of course. So basically OTC trading, centralized exchanges and decentralized exchanges or DeFi and DeFi. So they create a new infrastructure for that, which is kind of a mesh network of broker nodes and a bit working like Lightning Network in the sense that you have this kind of one-to-one node transactions. And this enables these transactions to happen very quick and at the same time to they create, you know, if you look at the world of finance, there is a protocol called the FIX protocol, which is around basically exchanging data, messages, information between Forex traders. They are basically recreating that in the crypto space on a decentralized network. So I think that's quite, you know, very interesting. And it's a kind of project where if they do it well and if it works, can become really massive because, you know, it's crypto trading. And what we know until now is that the most valuable and the most lucrative activity in crypto until now has been crypto trading. And the team, well, the team is great because they have experience in finance. They have experience in already the matching engines for the exchanges. So yeah, if the team could do it, I think it could be them. And so we like that challenge that they're taking.
Alexi, who, by the way, also came on the podcast
a few months ago. Yes, that's right. So him.
Amazing guy. The next one is that you really like is Lens Protocol that we kind of mentioned before.
Yes.
Why should people pay attention to Lens Protocol, which they're building, but we don't hear about them too much at the moment, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure that's a bad thing, to be honest. But
fair enough.
Again, infrastructure, you know, social graph is what you build social media apps on. And obviously you need someone to build and also to think through and to improve social graphs for Web3. Because again, in Web2, we have, they are,
What is
thousands
a social
of
graph?
Tools. Social graph is, well, basically the network of the network, the infrastructure network of social media, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, but in the sense of Web3 is a bit different between, because social graph is kind of this web of relations and data, right? So in the Web3, you have to make sure that the social graph is adapted so that portability is possible, so that you can actually use this data, your own data, have ownership of your data and use it easily on other, you know, I was talking about primitives like identity, etc. So on all applications of that use the social graph of Lens Protocol, you can easily, you know, onboard. You don't need to redo the whole thing, like who are you? No, because you have a wallet. Your wallet has already recorded certain information of data. So social graph is for this, but also Lens is working on, you know, actual data storage, you know, data efficiency as well for these new social media Web3 applications.
I said before, Ethereum is sort of like the Android or iOS for decentralized application. How could we make someone who doesn't understand anything about Web3 help them understand Lens Protocol? Mm-hmm. What's the equivalent in Web2? Or is there an equivalent?
Yeah.
Because, for example, Facebook or LinkedIn are built, what are they built on? On the internet, right?
Yeah.
Or is there something underlying? Because Lens is basically that protocol where...
Yeah, but in the Web2 space, the difference is the Web2 space is we are used to... We're used to use it. We're not used to, you know, I'm not a Web2. Well, I've been in a way a long time ago, but I think the difference is why do we look at infrastructure in Web3 is because it hasn't existed for, you know, it's getting built now. Mm. In Web2, these big companies, they either created their own.
Exactly.
Their own, yeah. Or they used existing ones, but nobody knows about them because we're just users. You know, we're not active players in that space. Or at least I'm not. I never built a social media in Web2, right? So yes, there are equivalent in Web2, of course, but you cannot say Lens Protocol is a Facebook because obviously Lens Protocol is a layer under Facebook, right? So Facebook would need a social graph to build on, but we can imagine that a company like Facebook probably have their own, basically, yeah.
So essentially,
also there is no need for portability in Facebook because each of them have their own database, so they don't need to be able to share it with anyone else.
So if Ethereum is the decentralized is the iOS or Android for decentralized application in general, we could almost say that Lens Protocol would be a sort of Android or iOS for decentralized social media applications.
Kind of operating system.
It's the underlying protocol of the future of social media, which is needed. Otherwise, we can't have any of the Web3 benefits in these applications, right?
Yeah. Of course, they are competing propositions, but I think it's a good move in a very new space like Web3. It's a good move to go for the infrastructure part. I think it's very important because then you have all these applications building on you, and they rely on you. But it's very similar to L2s and Ethereum. L2s rely on Ethereum to be working so that they can, thrive as well. So yeah, in that sense. But Lens Protocol is interestingly building on an L2, which is Polygon. So we have these multiple layers here already.
Do you want to say a few words about the team of Lens Protocol, which are
basically the community knows Lens Protocol because they developed Aave, which is a very successful, very large DeFi platform. I think 10 billion plus value locked on Aave, and active platform, and on different blockchains, by the way. So not just one, but several blockchains. So they have know-how to build that. So I mean, again, Lens Protocol is for example, the Byzantium team. I know they sometimes talk to the Lens Protocol team. They have to. They're building on them. They have to find out solutions to problems, technical problems, etc. So I think it's all it's all work in progress. It's not like Lens is not perfect yet, of course, because they are building and they are learning as new applications develop on them, right? So that's the nature of crypto as well. Ever evolving.
You mentioned Camino on Solana before.
Yeah, just again, I don't know them. I haven't invested in the platform itself. But I use it, but I haven't invested in it. Or Consilium hasn't invested in that platform. Just to highlight the fact that, again, even if these platforms are all more or less doing the same thing, it's interesting to see they have different communities, different approaches, and some of them are just more interesting for some than others. So, there is still this choice coming. So yeah, very active, very dynamic. They seem to roll out cool products, interesting products, things that basically make your life easier because they are already, it's like, on DeFi, sometimes you start doing certain strategies and then you find these platforms that actually have automated the strategy for you. So it basically does it for you. So the Camino is one of those and many are coming in that direction.
So Camino is built on Solana.
Mm-hmm.
Solana, which had an existential crisis about a year ago.
Yeah.
Like Ethereum had in the previous cycle.
Yeah.
And that seems to have emerged as kind of like the new darling of this cycle. What are your thoughts on Solana, especially based on all your experience, 10 years in crypto, you've seen this over and over again. You've seen the Bitcoiners thinking kind of like they're the king of the world and then hating on Ethereum, which then became something really big. And then you have the same happening to Ethereum maxis saying that Solana is shit, doing like a sort of like death party at sort of the bottom. And then Solana that comes back out of the blue.
Yeah, when I discovered Solana, not that early. I've discovered when probably most people start hearing about it. Again, the test is very simple. You start using it, and very easy to use. You know, Phantom Wallet. But there are other wallets, Soulflare, etc. You know, I'm not, again, no investments there. But you know, you use it. It's easy. It's fast. They had issues. All blockchains had issues at first. They had problems at some point where yeah, people couldn't use it for hours. You know, yeah, I remember that. But
yeah, yeah,
that hasn't happened recently. But anyway, so yeah, I think the fact that you can use it simply, not that easy for me to understand, because you know, I'm used to looking at on the blockchain, you know, blockchain explorers. I'm used to look at Bitcoin or I'm used to look at Ethereum. So I'm not that familiar with, for example, the way the Solana Explorer, Scanner, Scan Explorer, et cetera, show the transactions and so forth. But as a user, I think it works fast. It works well. So, you know, again.
And it's cheap.
And it's cheap.
Super important.
Cheap. I think the important thing is we're going into this space where we need applications that can be easily used by newcomers. So we're talking about, you know, Web3 social media, that's one space, advertising, etc. But if you look at DeFi, it's the same. You know, DeFi on certain platforms, let's say Curve, not that easy. You know, I mean, you need some experience. On Solana, on Camino, Margin5, Meteora, you know, it seems a bit more intuitive. It's a bit easier. And there are less steps. There is less, yeah. So again, you have to be careful because, you know, it's DeFi is money, right? But you feel that these platforms are using Solana in a way to make it easy for users. And that's extremely important for the future of these platforms, you know. So it's not only about, you don't need to be an insider, you know, to use it. It's not only about, you need to learn, of course, but maybe it's a bit quicker to grasp it.
You don't need to be an insider and don't need to be a whale spending hundreds of dollars for every transaction.
Yeah, correct.
Which is definitely extremely important.
Yeah.
So we had some crypto alpha. Let's talk about business building alpha. You've not only built businesses, but you also invested in quite a lot of entrepreneurs and you've seen it all. So let's get some entrepreneurship alpha. You told me that the number one thing that is extremely important for people who want to take the leap in the entrepreneurship world is to understand that question, which is basically, are you ready to sacrifice everything?
Yeah.
Why do you think that sacrificing everything is required for an entrepreneur to be successful?
I don't think it's required. It's not the same to sacrifice everything or to be ready to, or to have the mentality, the strength to actually be able to sacrifice. But my personal experience, and as we know, the experience of many entrepreneurs, famous ones, for example, is that at some point they had to sacrifice a lot. You know, everything is hard to define, but a lot. And anyone who wants to think they're going to have some kind of comfortable journey or entrepreneurship is easier than salary work or easier than it's actually harder than anything else. And there is this expression that we see on Twitter now these days, which I agree is a 10-year overnight success. Mm. You know, and I agree with that. I think there is no overnight success and everyone has had difficult time, especially the ones that look the most successful today. And unfortunately, the kind of things you cannot explain because you have to live it. You know, it's like you cannot tell people, oh, you should be in the mindset of sacrificing, but until they get there, then you find out if they are or not really, right? Mm. So I think that's one important element, and the other that we discussed is persistence, which it goes kind of hand in hand with sacrifice. It seems to me that often, and I've seen that in crypto very clearly, often people give up because at some point you feel like, you know, like for example, mid 2017, we had like 2014 to 2017 was almost like a crypto desert. I mean, we called it crypto winter, but this case was almost like a desert, so long, you know. And I've seen very talented entrepreneurs give up, move to another industry, stop their whatever they have built a few months before the largest hype bull run cycle that was coming. So we always feel that there is this time where really some people feel, okay, that's too much. And that's where persistence and sacrifice comes in. If they continued 6 months more, they could have been successful, you know, clearly. So I think, this is a... Patience and persistence.
You told me you saw some people work 10 years.
Yes.
And then made all their money in their 11th year.
Yeah, yeah. Even in crypto, which is interesting because crypto, you know, if you look at Bitcoin, you think, oh, okay, people made a lot of money before, etc.
Absolutely.
But there is a big difference in this space between holding Bitcoin and building a business in that space. And therefore, you know...
Well, you could argue that even holding Bitcoin and not fucking up and losing your Bitcoin
is also
much more difficult than what people think. Or just not selling them too early or not being caught in a hack or not leverage trading your Bitcoin until you lose everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which, there are many risks. Yeah.
Which I know a lot of people...
In this case,
me included, who've done that. So
in this case, passivity was actually the best answer. So on entrepreneurial, you have to be extremely dynamic and active, but holding assets, passivity probably helps. but not too passive, because then you have maybe your ledger screen doesn't work at some point, which happened to me as well.
Happened the other day. I think obviously Steve Jobs was saying the same, was saying, I'm convinced, I don't remember the exact numbers, but something like, I'm convinced that 90% of what separates successful entrepreneurs from non-successful entrepreneurs is just perseverance.
Perseverance,
basically never stopping. And I read something on LinkedIn the other day about a guy who I know who built a mega business. And he was saying something along the way. It was the same. And essentially, it was, you can't fail if you don't stop. And that's something that people don't really, you know, especially when you start a business or whatever, you just think, oh, it's kind of like all black and white. Mm. Either I'm successful, either I'm not. But the truth is, no. Mm. If you find a way to like at least pay for your very simple life, that's why starting early is actually a good thing. Starting very early is bad because you don't have network, you don't have experience, you don't understand anything. But one of the good things is with 1K a month, like you can live, like you eat some pasta, you have like a shit room somewhere and you can start building. And then at some point you realize, oh man, actually being on this journey is not that hard. And as long as I can have a roof like and have some food, I can continue forever until I find the right thing. And again, exactly as you said before, the 10-year overnight success is exactly that. Many people on this podcast were mega successful. One of the last ones we had is Johan, the co-founder of Wintermute. Mm-hmm. Wintermute is his fourth company. Mm-hmm. I mean, fourth real company, but he also started a lot of side projects, invested in a lot of projects, and he was saying, and he's super intelligent, 148 IQ and everything, so like kind of really gifted. But like it's just perseverance and just... And some luck at some point, but as we always say, luck is when preparation meets the opportunity. And so if you just never stop, you're preparing yourself along the way to when the right opportunity happens, you just take it and you just go all in. And at some point, it's, as you said the other day, it's very unlikely that if you sacrifice everything and are patient and persistent, it's almost impossible not to be successful at some point. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's going to take much more time than you think, and people are not willing to sacrifice that much for that long to be successful.
Yeah, and I think many very big companies, names that we know, have been built that way. You know, have been built late, have been built after a lot of efforts, going through a lot of problems. Even in my I remember, I don't know exactly the time, but in the late 90s, I was looking at, you know, entrepreneurs and I remember some early entrepreneurs struggling, you know, the famous, you meet 200, you know, potential investors, you know, et cetera. Mm. It sounds daunting, but they have gone through it. You know, they have met, you know, 200, maybe more, 300 people before they can get their project off the ground. And that's also, you know, perseverance, patience, and also crazy ideas. I remember one which is quite known in Singapore now, Dyson. You know, Dyson. I remember when he started.
He's based here. Oh, he was based here, and then he's moved back.
But they're quite present as a brand, as a company here. And I remember when he started his bagless vacuum. You know, it sounded both a good idea, but at the same time a bit, you know, like, why is that important or whatever. And it was, again, not an overnight success. You could feel that a lot of work had been going into that enterprise, which is today, you know, I don't know, $1 billion company, right? Mm. Yeah. So I have I've been following a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of companies, and we can see that this is the usual cycle. It's a lot of struggles to get there.
Another one I want to talk about is, I love it, this one, doing the thing versus talking. Especially if we think about doing the thing versus talking in the new world, which is social media. Mm. And in this entire world of fake it till you make it. Yeah. Because it basically means that you're talking, and hoping that you're building a momentum that at some point is going to work. And if you think about it, starting a company from scratch, you need to have a bit of that, right?
Yeah.
You need to build momentum. So it's part of like kind of the sales and like building this momentum with employees or partners or investors or potential clients. But I know you are someone who doesn't talk too much but does things, right? So like, what's your take on doing the thing versus talking?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, talking is part of the equation, and good communicators, yeah, they do well as well in terms of selling their project and so forth. I'm always reticent to talk too much. I really prefer people who do and show results. And it's true that you're right. There is different cultures, you know. There are cultures in Europe where people like to talk.
In Europe?
Yeah, in Europe, you know.
Which ones, for example?
Well, the ones I know the most, right?
But tell us more. Give us some Europe alpha.
No, I think the whole world knows. It doesn't, no need to for me to say, to say which countries. But the interesting thing is that there are two possible ways. Some people talk, and talking helps them. I mean, it's true, it always helps. Bouncing ideas and getting feedback if they listen. I mean, talk and listen. Then that could be good. And by talking, they can fine-tune their ideas. You know, it can be helpful. I agree, it can be helpful. The problem is when talking becomes, you know, 90% of your activity, and then basically you don't have time to do it, or you forget about doing it, which is quite a danger as well. And as you were saying on social media, you know, these days it's funny, you have this post around LinkedIn where people have a normal job and it becomes a 10 sentence on LinkedIn and makes it sound like, you know, and that's where you go a bit too far and you start forgetting, you know, what you should be doing. But yeah, I'm in favor of less talk, but I know that talking helps some people to get there as well.
And in the social media world, there is some really big examples of people who build massive wealth very young, in their 20s, even late teens or early 20s, talking about, you know, 50, 100 million by talking and showing and saying, hey, look at my life. I'm driving a Lambo. I'm with all these hot girls. I live in Dubai. And most of it is not true in the beginning. And then it's, hey, look, I have this social media agency or whatever kind of business, e-com or whatever, like, could be anything.
and then you will start to sell courses for people to kind of be able to replicate your life, saying, hey, thanks to my social media agency, I'm able to have this life because I can make 100,000 a month or a million a month, which is not necessarily true. Or maybe for some it's true, but probably not for most, right? And then the younger people will buy this dream and buy all these courses, and the person actually is making lot of money
from selling the courses.
Yeah. It's an older model, talking, right?
To be honest. I mean, in the 70s, 80s, maybe earlier, I don't know, I wasn't born, but in the 70s, 80s, this is something I could see in magazines.
Mm.
In magazines, you had people, ads, advertising, I'm doing fine, I have a secret method, send me 100 French francs. That's the secret method, you know? Is the people going to buy the secret method, you know? And it's exactly the same as what you're saying. It's just a different medium, you know, because social media is... You can, you can reach out to the world, right? It was also the model, if you remember, of the bodybuilding scene. That was funny advertising in the 70s, 80s, where you see, but you still see this today, you know, like before and after, you know, like maybe a little bit overweight, you know, and then after extremely fit person, maybe the same guy, we don't know. But that was the same in the magazines.
Hopefully the same.
That was the same in the magazines before, right? And what they were selling were either methods or products. Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of the, not it didn't change that much. Bigger reach.
Do you think that people who talk a lot, essentially bullshit a lot, can pass the bullshit filter of people who are extremely successful, which we both know are usually fairly low-key, don't talk too much, and have a kind of nose and feeling for these kind of people?
Yeah, they do, of course, yeah. I think they can. I mean, we have some examples in the world, right? Because in the world of investment, there is always, first of all, as we know, and interestingly, it's also something we were speaking about before, you know, the human part, right?
Mm.
Financial investment, like DeFi and yields, and this is a sector where you don't need you want to avoid human bias, right? The trading, in trading, you want to avoid human emotions, human bias. But if you talk about startup, that's all it is. It's human emotion and human bias, because there is no number, there is nothing that can tell you this deck, this 12-page deck, will become LinkedIn or Facebook. Nothing can tell you, right? Because there is nothing precise there. So you don't have the data, right? So interestingly enough, in that world, which is a world that has grown tremendously, the startup investment field, right, is a world that you cannot take decisions on data only. You have to feel the person, you have to trust the person, you have to... So I think in that field, definitely people who can talk well, who can explain their idea well, can convince experienced investors, because experienced investors have seen cases where people who talk well as well have done well. I mean, and have other reasons to like or trust someone. So definitely, yeah. And they are, and I know, but so I won't say names in that context, but I know people who have done that successfully, and they are Fortune 500 companies today.
Mm.
Because then you have then once you have passed a certain stage, a certain level of investment, you have reached a level where you get the actual professional help you need to actually do it, right? So you know, you talk,
absolutely.
But if you're smart enough, at some point after having raised millions, then you hire the people to actually do what you were aiming to do.
It's basically back to this notion of building momentum, becoming a master at building momentum, and like the talking really helps in the beginning if you do it right. But you really need to understand that at some point you're going to have to be able to fall back on your feet.
I mean, someone like Vitalik, I remember reading his articles in the Bitcoin magazine, and also the way he was arguing. I don't know how old he was, maybe 18. I don't know, 2013, whatever old he was then. very clear arguments, very good arguments. And of course, that helped a lot when he came up with his project, Ethereum, because, you know, he had a history of good arguing and good responses on different blog centers, posts, etc., where people could see, okay, this guy knows what he's talking about. You know, he was doing very good arguments, very well-constructed arguments. And I think that helped him a lot. Mm. And of course, Vitalik, after then we realized actually he can do things. He's not just somebody who talks, but that helped him, definitely. It helps all entrepreneurs, obviously, to be able to clearly and concisely express your opinion. But he wouldn't be in the category of the one who speaks too much. But he was explaining very well what he meant, and he still communicates very well, I say, I feel. So yeah, communication is important.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you need people who
it's not
do
the only
work.
Thing that you can have in your entrepreneurship tool. I wanted to thank you, Eddie.
Thank you.
Not only for being here today, but also for being the very first person who really believed in us when Shift Happens, the podcast,
okay.
And
pleasure.
Supported us all along. And yeah, we could definitely not have built what we've been building, which is, by the way, just the start, just beginning, if you didn't jump in and gave us the extra push and the financial help to make this happen. So again, from the When Shift Happens team, and from the audience who is growing by the day, thank you so much.
No, you're welcome, and looking forward to the next steps of When Shift Happens.
Absolutely.
And your next steps.
Thank you.
Thank you.